Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and my next guest has written a book that argues disability liberation and animal liberation are intimately tied together, and that the systems that degrade and tie down both disabled people and animals are intricately linked. The author is Sonora Taylor, and she's an artist, writer, and now author of a new book called Beasts of Burden, Animal and Disability Liberation. Hi, Sonora. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much for having me.
And before we dig into the narrative in the book even, can I ask you to define a few terms for our listeners? So one of them is ableism.
Okay, great. Yeah. So ableism, I think, is easiest to understand if you think about it similarly to racism or sexism, that it's sort of pointing to the ways in which disability is devalued, the way in which disabled people are marginalized and oppressed.
And not a new word in disability rights circles, but still one that not that many people know, ableism.
Yeah, exactly.
What about CRIP?
CRIP. So CRIP, sort of, again, like queer, is a word that a lot of politicized disabled people use to point to the ways in which disability is not just a personal struggle or a personal tragedy, but actually that it's a social justice issue. And so CRIP, of course, from cripple, is sort of a way of reclaiming a word that has been
So people with certain kinds of disabilities are calling themselves that.
Yes, exactly.
Like gay people call themselves queer.
Exactly.
Things
yeah.
like that. There's a story in the book, to let people get to know you a little bit more, of some children who made fun of you in kindergarten. Do you want to tell that story?
Sure. So, I mean, I think so this book is not a memoir. It is but I use a personal narrative throughout as a sort of way of illustrating the ideas that I'm getting to. So in this book, I talk about a lot about what it would mean for a dehumanized community to actually be able to claim their animality or not just associate animality with negativity. And so I talk about my own experiences as a young person being told that I walk like a monkey. I use a wheelchair, but I can walk some. And then I sort of think about both my positioning as someone who has been negatively compared to animals, but also my privileges as a white, non-intellectually disabled person. And so what it means for me to claim animal versus someone else.
And so the comparison of disabled people to animals, what you call human animalization, like those kids did to you in kindergarten, was so obviously on display in the sideshows and the circuses of the 19th century in some of the history that you recount. Can you talk a little bit about that and how it relates to sort of policy and rights issues today?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think what I try to do, numerous things through the book, but one of them is, and I'm not a historian, but trying to give a brief sort of historical analysis to the ways in which disabled people and animals have been compared. And so I look at histories of the sideshow and also the ways, the sort of connected histories of taking animals and humans to display them from
separate from quote unquote normal people.
Yes. So I examine those connected histories, but I'm also what I'm really trying to do with the book is to not say that animals are like disabled people, or that disabled people are like animals. So I don't do that history in order to show that sort of relationship. What I'm really trying to get at is the ways in which similar systems of oppression are at work in the way that we devalue these different communities.
Now, the utilitarian philosopher Peter Singer, who many would call the founder of the modern animal rights movement, was one of your heroes growing up, I see, after you read his seminal 1975 book, Animal Liberation. But many in the disability rights community hate Peter Singer. So give people some background as to why and if you find a synthesis.
Yeah. So I think that that was actually one of the things that led me to write this book is that for me, as someone who had always sort of identified as an animal advocate and then someone who, as I became older, really strongly identified with politicized disability communities, to me, these issues were always really connected. And so I had this really deep appreciation for Peter Singer's work as a young person. And so realizing that there was that deep conflict was sort of a shock to me. And so part of what has happened is that Peter Singer, in his book Animal Liberation and in later works, used intellectual disability as a way of making a case for animal rights. And this has sort of been adopted into the mainstream animal rights discourse in a way that is problematic and that has pushed some disability communities to really shy away from animal issues.
And you got to meet Peter Singer a couple of years ago and have a conversation with him. And you write that he asked you a question, whether you would take a $2 pill if it would erase your disability. And you answered?
I answered no. And I think that that was sort of emblematic of his position on disability. So he has numerous other works in which he said some very troubling things about disability, but one of them is this idea that disability is suffering, that disability is always a negative. And so that the assumption is, of course, that someone would automatically want to take this $2 pill. And this question is so common for disabled people to hear, and it's a very frustrating question because the lived experience is far more of disability is far more complicated than that, and also disability is not just a negative experience. It's actually a politicized identity. Some people, including myself, see it as a very creative way of inhabiting a body.
And you quote, for example, the disabled dancer, poet, and artist Neil Marcus, who has said disability is not a, quote, brave struggle or courage in the face of adversity. Disability is an art. It's an ingenious way to live.
Yeah. And so I love this quote, and I love Neil. He's done an amazing amount of work within disability culture and for disability arts. And obviously some people are going to hear that and just think that's absurd. But I think that both positions can be true, that disability does have elements of struggle. It has elements of pain. It often has roots in injustice. But it also can be an extremely creative and in liberating way of inhabiting one's body.
So listeners, especially those of you with a disability, do you see your rights as intrinsically tied together with the rights of animals or not, or anything else that you might want to say after hearing this much of Sonora Taylor, artist, writer, and now the author of a new book, Beasts of Burden, Animal and Disability Liberation, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. There's a whole chapter in your book about Bowie, a chimp used for research who learned dozens of words in American Sign Language and could express emotions, really, and communicate in full sentences. He even made up a funny nickname for his teacher, and he became famous, as some of our listeners know, after a 2020 special on him back in the 90s and inspired sympathy and respect for his communication skills. But that admiration troubled you.
Yeah, no, so I tell Bowie's story. So Bowie was a chimpanzee. He was taught sign language, and then he was basically sold into research. And he spent 13 years in a cage having scientists do hepatitis research on him. And so I tell Bowie's story because there was outrage at the time because these chimps knew sign language. And some of them were actually released. The really famous ones were released. Two of them were released. And Bowie wasn't, because it wasn't publicly known that he couldn't speak. And so I tell his story, actually, not to point to how amazing it is that he used sign language, but to ask the question of why we consider a being who can communicate in a particular way as being deserving of freedom, and another being who has the same emotional capacity, has different emotional capacities, but who might not have that skill that.
Yeah, so yeah. It was really people's attachment to Bowie, and the fact that people were outraged that this, of all chimps, was used for hepatitis research. That troubles you.
Yeah. I mean, I think that he represents the way in which human beings privilege human capacities, human abilities, and particularly able-bodied and neurotypical abilities, such as language.
Let me ask you about an issue that's out there in the abortion rights debate. Because genetic and other kinds of testing for pregnant women, obviously common, and people can choose whether to continue to carry a fetus if they're told it will be born with a disability. And the anti-abortion rights movement has been raising this to more prominence lately. In fact, I think Mike Pence, when he was governor of Indiana, signed a bill that would have outlawed abortion for the sake of disability prevention. How do you feel about that?
I feel like it's very problematic to try to pit disability rights against women's reproductive rights against each other in that way. And I think that reproductive rights should include the choice to have a disabled child and to have the support services that are needed. There's no doubt that those support services are lacking in so many ways, and so it's harder for people to raise a disabled child. But abortion is a woman's choice and a very difficult choice, and those issues, I do not see them as at odds.
It sounds like you didn't find that a hard position to come to, even though the choice to abort fetuses with likely disabilities at birth seems to devalue disabled people.
Well, I think we can definitely look at the ways in which there's ableism at work there. And I think that's where there needs to be a more subtle conversation about why we devalue disabled people, why women would feel like they don't want, or more to my point, I think, is why they feel like they maybe can't also raise a disabled child if there aren't the support services there available. So to me, I think that there's no doubt some ableism at work in the way that issue is framed at points, but to pit them against each other again is not helpful, I think, for the disability community or for women's reproductive rights.
My guest is Sonora Taylor, author of Beasts of Burden, Animal and Disability Liberation, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Dan in Newark, you're on WNYC. Hi, Dan.
Hi. I will admit that we suffer a glut of PhDs in biosciences now, which in essence, from the point of view of animals, is like a glut of butchers. But the fact is that if you look at birds, they have far superior cognitive abilities than chimps on all tests done so far. And even chickens have amazing cognitive abilities, even laterality of the brain, which is the source of our great cognitive characteristics. But the fact is that without the research, most of what we know, you don't get it. Without the knowledge, we go back to a state of operation, which was real dark ages. So, you know, always argue the case of the costs and the benefits, mm-hmm. and then you can argue the ethics, because otherwise, you know, it's just the other side of the same stupid argument that was made, that God chose man as a special species.
I understand. You're nodding. What do you think?
I mean, I think that you raised some important points just about the the capacities of animals and the ways in which actually those capacities are often not, we don't think about chickens as having, you know, any sort of intelligence, actually, for the most part, when actually there's so much evidence that they do. And but I want to sort of trouble the idea that an animal is intelligent only if it's similar in intelligent only to human beings. And so I think that that's one of the things that I'm trying to get to. Is that there's a variety of abilities and a variety of ways of inhabiting a mind and a body.
Do you come down in the book firmly on the, you know, on a position on using animals in medical research?
Yeah, so I am opposed to using animals in research. I think that often this sort of
period or under any certain circumstances of, you know, cruelty.
I think that we need to invest more more funding, more efforts into developing other ways of doing research. And actually, I think a lot of those technologies exist already and have existed for quite a while now. And that there's a lot of research out there that points to the fact that animals actually do not actually make that great research subjects, that a lot of bad science can come out of using animals. So But I also think that you know, I think I disagree with the caller in terms of, like, ethics. I don't think can come second, because that can justify a lot of really horrible stuff. And animal science is one area where I think the ethical implications of what we are doing need to be at the forefront of our conversation.
I guess when he raises cost and benefits, he's posing, well, here's a hypothetical. Is there any degree of benefit for humans that would justify any degree of cost to animals used for research?
You see, so one of the things that I try to move away from in my book is these sort of cost-benefit analyses, because I think that's often where the conversation goes around animal issues, you know, of like, oh, well, if you were on a desert island, wouldn't you eat some sort of, you know, some sort of animal? And I think what I want to point out is that actually the vast majority of animal use in this country and elsewhere in the world is for things that are not remotely at odds like that, is for things like testing household products and cosmetics, and, you know, which there's no way that we can argue that those are essential for our survival.
Rhoda in Stamford, you're on WNYC. Hi, Rhoda.
Hi. I am visually impaired and legally blind, and I have a condition that is still being researched, and it doesn't look like anything in the horizon at the moment. And what upsets me is when I hear these commercials about saving the dogs and sending money to animal shelters, when so much more has to be done in research for people, especially who have eye conditions, and they still haven't been uncovered, and there are no methodologies to stop the eye loss.
And you see the money that might go to saving the dogs or whatever as working against what should be a higher priority?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, again, I would say that I think that there's, you know, so much funding that goes to things that I would rather see go elsewhere. But that as my sister is fond of saying, compassion is not a limited resource. That we should be able to do both. We should be able to support research to help disabled individuals, and we should also be able to support animals and animals in shelters. So I don't see them as at odds. Again, I see that as a sort of false binary.
You end your book with a really sweet and poignant description of your dog, Bailey, who's disabled himself. You write, quote, "There is a sense of something appropriate, beautiful, actually, about being a gimped-up, dependent, inefficient, incapable human supporting and being supported by my inefficient, dependent, and gimped-up dog, two vulnerable, interdependent beings of different species learning to understand what the other one needs, unquote. In our last minute, is there anything else you want to say about the way we humans should coexist with animals or about Bailey?
I love Bailey. So, but I think at this time, especially right now, thinking about climate change, it's really important to recognize that we are all vulnerable and we are all animals and we are all interconnected. And on some level, that sounds cheesy, but I think actually that if we are going to have a thriving and or even surviving time on this planet, that is something that we all have to start addressing.
Are you a New Yorker?
I am, yeah.
So
yeah.
Bailey might be out there right now.
Bailey is in Washington Square Park a lot. So.
Hi, Bailey. Hi, Bailey. Good dog. Good dog. Hi, Bailey. All right. We have to leave it there for today. My guest has been Sonora Taylor, artist, writer, disability and animal rights advocate, and the author of the new book, Beasts of Burden, Animal and Disability Liberation. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.